Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focus Compounding, on air live with Jeff Gannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. This is the first time you're tuning in with us. Thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. The best way to do that is to follow me on X at Focused Compound. All the information is in the description below. If you're going to be in Omaha and you would like to meet up with Jeff, reach out to me at andrew@focusedcompounding.com. If you have a interesting podcast topic or question that you would like us to discuss on the podcast, email it to me at andrew@focusedcompounding.com. We'll love to poll those questions and make a particular podcast out of that. So in today's podcast, Jeff, we're going to be talking about inflation and how that matters to specific companies and just stocks in general. So inflation is definitely going to be the buzzword of the 2020s. I think that's how we're going to remember this. It's been proven to be sticky, and it seems like interest rates are going to be higher for longer, as we've talked a lot about on this podcast. So inflation is something that we're going to have to discuss more often, or at least think about as we are looking at different companies and different stocks. So want to get your opinion on how you typically think about it, how you work it into your valuations, how you think about how it relates to individual companies and stocks in general.
So the stocks that are best for picking to see the beneficiaries of inflation, right, are anything where the outflows were in the past and the inflows are in the future. Right? Because in terms of nominal things that we're looking at here, everything gets thrown off because everything isn't restated for the past, because it's all at unrealistic levels compared to what future prices are, right? So everything is understated in terms of what happened in the past. And then in the future, you want to benefit from that because you're paying in dollars today for the company, right? So some of those things are stuff that are hard assets, right? But some of them aren't, because you're buying the company, you're not buying the asset. So if you buy a company that owns a bunch of gold or oil or whatever, and it's just going to pay it all out to you in dividends, right, then that's a big beneficiary from inflation. But if they're going to take all that money and buy more gold and oil with 100% reinvestment rate, then you're not going to be a big beneficiary of that at all, even though they both are categorized as if they're in the same industry. We've talked sometimes about supermarkets. That's an example. Some of them lease them, others own them, but basically they're doing more volume at the same sorts of things. There's a company that's going to merge, but I think QuickFS has all the old data on it. Ticker FUN, Cedar Fair, is another good example, because although it's an entertainment company, where all of their investment was historical. You know, they have heavy investment in parks, buying them and putting in rides and everything. And now they have higher levels of revenue, purely driven by the fact that there's been a bunch of inflation, basically, right? So they'll still have CapEx in the future. This company is going to be Six Flags and Cedar Fair combined. But we're now understating what it was before. They bought entire parks. They own all this land. They have all these rides, all this stuff, that now it's, in a sense, it might look surprising to us, oh, they're going to earn more money in the future. What happened? Did something get better with the business? No. It turns out that the market value and the cost to reproduce all that they have goes up in nominal dollars. And realistically, their return on equity and all that stuff may not be better in the future than the past if we marked up the assets to market. But we don't do that. We use the old balance sheet numbers. So as a result, it'll look like the business is suddenly better, right? Because you're not reproducing all of that stuff. They don't go out and buy all that acreage and put on all those rides again. They did that in the past, and it cost what it did then. It doesn't change it. But now, if you restate in today's dollars, it will look like they spent more. One way to think about it is, like, you go to a site like Measuring Worth or whatever, you know, that can do the inflation adjustment for you. If they told you we spent $20 million to put in some ride in 2004, you go back now and check that. If you checked in 2019, it would tell you in 2019 dollars one price. Check in today's dollars, it's higher. So you, if although they did the one event once in the past, now each time you go back and look at it, it's going to look like it was more and more expensive. But that's not captured anywhere in the financial statements. And so it's companies that benefit that way from it because of the way that our brains work with thinking in money terms all the time. We get confused that that price is changing all the time. The value of a dollar changes all the time. And we think that because the value of the dollar went down, that means that these things are getting better, when really it's the dollar that moved, not them.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other industries that you could think of that also fall sort of in that bucket? I mean, we've spoken a lot about steel and how you think there's going to be a lot of M&A in the steel industry just because the replacement cost is way higher than where a lot of these companies are trading at from like a valuation perspective in the market. Is there anything else that comes to mind?
Yeah, so similar to that. Mathematically, it's anything where the entry and exit of the industry is low, right? And the asset life is long. If you have either high entry and exit or short asset life, it may not matter as much. It doesn't actually matter if it's tangible or intangible. If you have intangibles that last forever, that's actually really valuable. So it doesn't make a difference that way, but it's things that have a long asset life versus a short. And then, like I said, everything is really shorter than it appears to be if there's entry and exit in the industry, right? Because that means that they're not all consist of the same assets, even at the corporate level it's changing. But if the corporate level isn't changing much at all, and then you have long asset life, then it's something that benefits a lot. And so the ones we just said are that, and everyone knows those, right? Like everyone knows the statistics of how many, think about it. How often did you hear about a new steel plant opening in the United States? How often have you heard of a new nuclear power plant? How long has it been since you heard of a new oil refinery? There's all sorts of things that you can think the United States has a lot of, and yet there haven't been many built for a really long time. Well, that means that they're in nominal dollars. Yeah, they're more valuable. I mean, let's go to U.S. Steel. X is the ticker, right? It was at one time. I know that they had the X ticker back when they were a big Dow company and stuff, I think. So United States Steel, to be acquired by a Japanese steel company, but at a much higher price than today's price, right? So the offer is 55. Do you remember the exact offer?
I think something like that, sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what are we at now on the price?
$39.
And why is that? Have you been following the story?
Well, I imagine people don't think it's going to go through, right?
Well, all the presidential candidates and the parties and stuff are saying it's terrible. Yeah. I don't know if that will stop it from going through. Generally the presidents are not the people who decide whether a merger closes or not, but all the politicians are against it, right? Because they hate unions, or they hate foreigners, or they hate both, or whatever, but it's all, that the union's against it and Americans are against it. I mean, probably most Americans don't care about it, but anyone who cares about it is against it, right?
Well, so I mean, that's how much a lot has gotten blocked though with the current administration. So I mean, don't you think this is sort of just like easy pickings for it not to go through?
No, honestly, I don't think that that's the case. But really, I'm not saying that it can't go through. Well, we could get into it. There's lots of reasons. The U.S. and Japan are allies, and if the Japanese prime minister just wants to say, make sure this goes through and I'll give you something, then they'll have to say yes. Because if you want our military participation on U.S., U.K., Australia alliance and stuff, he can just say, by the way, Mr. President, we need this deal to go through. And they'll go, okay. They're not going to worry about, what would happen if Taiwan's invaded to protect the United States steel from being bought by a Japanese company. The company buying and the company selling it are not radically different companies or anything. You know what I mean? So the things you talked about being blocked. Yes. One, in the United States, just trying to block something was big thing. So some of these until recently didn't even attempt to go through if that happened. Right. And then the other thing is, a lot of them were things that could be blocked based on rules that were already in place, having a better case for it. There's not a good case for doing this, but they can always come up with things, national security and stuff. I mean, yeah, you can, mm-hmm. if you want to, the government can block anything that they want if they can make rules about. They're going to, you know, they're considering banning TikTok and stuff. So, yeah, there's nothing in place to do that before. But what I meant about U.S. Steel is this price is a premium. I think the other offers were around 35 or something. Do you remember what other bidders yeah. knew about? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you look, there are some intangibles here. It shows you the price to book. But I remember there might be some intangibles on the balance sheet, but there's not a ton of intangibles, is my memory, on the balance sheet. So this isn't that. So the stock is not even trading at much of a premium to book value, I believe. Can you go to balance sheet and see if it gives you any information about that here in QuickFS? But yeah, it breaks out goodwill, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Goodwill, $920 million. Other intangibles, $361 million.
Okay. And what does it say for equity value right now?
Equity value, $11.1 billion.
Okay. So maybe it's 10% of the balance sheet is intangibles and stuff. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sorry, not 10% of the balance sheet, but 10% of the equity value. Mm-hmm. So anyway, what I'm saying is if it says it's 0.8 here or whatever, maybe it's 1x tangible book. I don't know, because we're not looking at the real balance sheet here. We're looking at QuickFS. But it's just interesting that something that is someone's trying to buy for, what did we say? That would be 1.2, 1.3 times tangible book or something, is with a hard offer on the table, trading below or at tangible book. But there's a great reason for it. If we go to the overview, we can see why, right? We don't even need to look at numbers. I think that we have a picture that will tell us why you would only pay book value for this, right?
Yeah.
So if you're looking at the video
picture,
we can look at return on invested capital. And for the last 20 years, U.S. Steel has had as many negative years as positive.
That's probably about true. Yeah, close to it. Yeah.
And I'd say their average return on capital is terrible, right?
It's, return on assets 2.4, return on equity 5.6, return on invested capital 3.7. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and which also is the explanation, though, is this is the problem, right? This is the best, you know, when we look at moats, right? The thing with moats is people always want to be in an industry and replacement costs and everything, right? Where they aren't going to open something up against you. The sad truth is how capitalism works and stuff. Yes. Why aren't you opening any new steel plants and stuff? Because the ones that already exist don't even make money.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about like nuclear plants? Wasn't there one that, I don't know if it's still in construction, but the last one to start being in construction, I don't know where it was, Atlanta, maybe Georgia, I'm not sure, but it's like, I don't know, billions of dollars over production, way delayed, years past it. I mean, just very complicated process to get one up and running in the United States.
Yeah, I don't.
Are you familiar?
Yeah, I don't think there'll ever be another civilian nuclear in the United States, probably. I think the United States is maybe the worst country in the world to put in a civilian reactor.
Why? Because of regulations or?
Regulation, the standards of living, regulations, attitudes towards safety, litigation, corporate things. If you want a nuclear power plant, you want to be, you know, a communist totalitarian state that has advanced scientific knowledge and ability to work with countries from around the world, but also will just say, no, no one gets paid if anything goes wrong. If it has anything wrong with it, it's our fault. Not have any standards that way. What happened from back to the 70s to now is, one, there's inflation caused materials costs of things to go up and stuff. And cost of capital went up, right? And they're very capital intensive. The way that it works is a nuclear plant compared to other things, you can always split kind of the recipe of how you make power. Some forms of power rely on some forms of that will produce electricity over time and sell it, rely on a heavy mix of capital and a light mix of variable costs, right? And input costs of like materials and stuff. And some have very heavy costs on those and then low costs on the other ones, right? So for instance, if we said, let's take natural gas. If you spend a lot on natural gas right before building a plant, right before COVID, it might not achieve that much for you because the capital costs are lower as a mix of your cost to produce electricity over the entire life of the plant and the variable cost of the actual material is high, right? Nuclear, as you know, uranium and like the actual cost of it as a material cost, especially, is quite low as a mix.
It's like nothing.
Yeah, there's added costs because of other things that you have to do with uranium and stuff, and you really should include all of that in the cost to them, which is not just the price of the material, but it's low. The actual thing is, will the plant operate 90%, 100%, whatever of the time, and how much did it cost in capital up front? Because what it really is how much did we sell equity for, did we borrow in terms of debt and stuff. And so one way to think about it is, if it was 100%, the plant was 100% funded with debt that you could finance forever and then apply the interest charges to us as sort of the simplest way of thinking about it, that's really much of the fuel cost, right? If I can borrow at 7% a year forever, right, and it's going to cost me $10 billion, right, then really my expense is like, you know, $700 million. You know what I mean? Like thinking in terms of those terms of that's my cost of capital and all that is a way to do it. With other kinds of fuel, right, that are used in other kinds of plants, the problem that you have is you don't know what the cost will be. We talk about MACO. Those plants, they kind of do know. I mean, they don't know because of diesel and labor and stuff costs, but they're sitting on a bunch of coal. That's different than if they're taking in by train from across the country and stuff. So if you're moving coal from all over the country to fuel a plant, in nominal terms, it could move all over the place, right? It could be that it's, you know, two or three times more per ton at one time than another. And then that's a very big part of the cost, or it's bigger than it was with nuclear, right?
The thing is about natural gas. Remember when natural gas prices went crazy high a couple years ago? The substitution went to coal, right? So that sort of brought things back down. Nuclear, there's mm-hmm. really no substitution for nuclear. And I've seen a Venn diagram before, which I thought was pretty funny. Obviously it was tongue in cheek, but it said like what the left hates about climate or carbons or whatever, climate change, what the right hates about it or likes about it. And like in the middle was nuclear. Like it was basically making the point that it should be like bipartisan, that nuclear energy is a great form of energy, you know?
Yeah. I'm not giving my opinion. I'm just telling you that I don't think it'll be built in the United States or that people will be for it. Yeah. I mean, you know, they're just things like that. And that's just the way that it is. So I just think that it won't happen. But like you said, nuclear and coal in the United States serve much the same purpose. There's other things that do too. There's hydroelectric and stuff. But a lot of that is replaced now over time by wind and solar, right? Which on their own aren't individually as reliable. But if they're part of a big mix with lots of other things on average, you know, they could be the new sources that you bring in. They're not an exact replacement really to replace coal and nuclear with wind and solar, but at this point they're fine because they're not a huge part of the mix. It only becomes a problem, like we talk about with indexing or something, right? We talk about passive versus active. If passive is 0 or 20 or 40, doesn't matter. If it's 80 or 99%, then yes, it would matter. You wouldn't want to run a grid on 99% solar, because what if you had a cloudy day? But if you could run it on 9%, it would not worry about it. So the thing that you said with nuclear is more extreme even with wind and solar. It's all about inflation and capital costs and stuff. So that's what I don't know about their future. I think it's hard to guess, because 10 years ago, I think cost of capital and inflation were incredibly low and there was a lot of desire to do ESG stuff. And so there was just, you know, I just think that it was easy to finance those sorts of projects, and in the future it might not be as easy, right? So, you know, it does affect things like that, obviously, because what it matters is the real stuff. You know, that's very easy to see in the case of those things that we're talking about, whether we're talking about steel or any of those. And that's why I think people talk about tangible stuff when they talk about inflation protection, is that, okay, everyone gets that it will cost more to do wind or solar. Again, I think it's confusing to people because, look, it's not really that they're less efficient physically or anything like that. What's changed is that the dollar is worth less. So it doesn't cost more of our resources as a society to do wind and solar than it did before. It costs more of these you know, bills, but they're less valuable, these bills. You know what I mean? And to not get confused about those two things. Because sometimes prices of things go up and down. Like oil is a good example. Like now someone might be saying, oh, well, oil is more expensive now than it was on average before COVID or something. Adjusted for inflation, it's not all that radically different on many days. It's because you're quoting it in dollars that it seems to be. Yeah, it's volatile, but the ranges that it's in are not wildly different ranges than we were used to before. But we just think of that. You see gasoline and you think, oh, if it says $4 instead of $3, but most things say something closer to $4 than $3 since COVID because there's inflation. So I think you could, that like you said with U.S. steel, you can imagine that with the replacement cost, you can imagine it with all of that, that it would be valuable. The issue there is, why does someone want to buy it? There's not a lot of people that want to buy it. The only people that want to buy it are steel companies. Yeah. And it's because they would like to, my guess for most of them is they'd like to be in the United States doing this. It would cost more to build anything themselves. That's not how they want to enter. They want to acquire something that already exists there. But so you can see that. So on the one hand, we could say, okay, great. Replacement cost is higher than this thing's selling for. You can tell, because that's why I picked this one, because there are other offers from other people to buy it. I don't think most people would say this is because everyone loves steel and wants to own it and stuff. This makes it obvious, like what inflation does and everything. But the downside is, look, the earnings from it are bad and have been bad for a long time. So that's the trade-off that you have when you have these wide moat things. But that's what it is. In theory, it would be something with a wide moat, right? We talk a lot about lime, and even those aren't perfect because the lime things like U.S. lime or something is sitting on deposits that it owns and everything. But some of the other things are not always. When people talk about cement things and stuff, they may own things and be integrated. Sometimes they're not. And then there's high input costs of different things that we talked about. Like with inflation, you have higher costs for different fuels and things. Like you might be using a lot of gas or something in some places. But that's what I find mostly. The best moats are moats where where it's not exciting for people to get into the industry. And the ones where people get into the industry, then it's hard to have a moat, right? That they'd be interested in getting in. It's the best way to scare them off is with low returns on capital. But honestly, it's things with moats and stuff. That's why Buffett did pretty well with inflation, right? Like some of his best record was in periods of high inflation. I think his really good record was mostly in periods of really high inflation, and his least good record versus others is in periods with really low inflation. Because he likes businesses with moats. So, I mean, a good business is a good business in real terms. So it's easier to see the difference between a good business and a not good business when inflation is very high. I think it's very hard to tell the difference between a good business and not so good business when inflation is closer to nothing. Because it's harder for anyone to like just go out and raise prices. You know, See's Candies, they raise prices a lot. But if there hadn't been inflation, it would have been tough to do. It's hard to sell people on the idea that we're just going to raise the price of something by 7% a year or something if there's no inflation. But if there is inflation of 3%, it's a little bit easier to raise it in real terms like that. And if there's inflation of 7%, it's pretty easy to raise it by 15%. So I think that you can see that benefit. And there's a tendency when the business is doing very badly, very competitive business, to not want to raise prices even though there is inflation so that your actual prices fall. And there's a bunch of industries where I bet that their average prices are falling and we don't pay as much attention to it. I don't know. You see things in the news, so I think this is a good thing to bring up. If Tesla or a company like that cuts prices, I think that makes news. I think if we have a 10% inflation rate and they don't touch prices, I don't think that makes news. Right? I don't think that there's news articles written saying in 2020 inflation was 10% or 2021 or whatever, and yet this industry kept its prices the same. I don't think that ever makes news. And yet it's the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. What are some other industries that you can think of that really benefit from inflation? You know, who is someone I know was complaining about his insurance premiums going up, car insurance. he was like, can you believe they're up like 20 or 30%, something crazy like that. And I was like, yeah, that's why insurance is a good business. And the person was saying, he's like, I mean, it's not like their costs have gone up that much. I'm like, yeah, well, insurance companies have pricing power, right?
So it's interesting. So I don't think we talked about this, but Geico has been doing not well recently, right? So it's inside Berkshire, but we can see some hints of this. Geico's lost a ton of market share in the last year. They're canceling people like crazy. You know what I mean? They're sending them things, raising them. So they're switching to go to Progressive and stuff. And it's for that reason. Geico has not been highly profitable recently. They're de-emphasizing advertising. I don't know if people have noticed that, but if you really think about it, I think you'll realize you've seen fewer Geico ads in the last year than you did 3 or 4 years ago. So they're de-emphasizing advertising and new customer acquisition. They're raising rates, which they know causes some people to cancel. And a lot of those people are going to other places like Progressive. And so they're making the trade-off between profitability and growth. And often market share does not change a lot. I can't think of a year where for Geico it will shift as much as part of the industry as it has in like the last year or something. So big change. But yeah, you have to have it from someone. So, you know, it's a question of who you'll then have it with. But you can sometimes tell which insurance companies are having issues that way because of if you get a bunch of quotes, which of these is not like the others, right? Sometimes some of them have additional information, which can contribute to giving you a different quote if you're an unusual risk or something. So sometimes you have that where one of them is not like the others for that reason, because they don't all share the exact information on that and the same models of how they think about things and stuff. So you might see that. I think you'll see that more if like you're driving a motorcycle, you had a few DUIs and stuff, you might get a more reasonable quote from one company than others. But if you're more standard risk and stuff, I don't think that you'll see that. Yeah, so it's a big thing where you see the increasing rates from some of them, right? I do think that costs have gone up a lot, but that has its own cycle. It's a better market for insurance than it was not that long ago. I don't think that... It's complicated because the insurance had some of its worst years in a period where it had inflation, but it's more complicated because I don't remember if it was 74 literally or what year, but that would have been a bad year sometime in that around those years. The economy was bad around then. So we are talking about moat things where they can't adjust, right? So I think those are the easiest to think about is they've done these decisions in the past. Now they either benefit from it or not. That's the easiest stocks to pick. Where we're getting to a more complicated category is insurance, banking, things like that, right? Insurance. Is it good or bad if there's inflation? It's complicated. If they can predict the future correctly, it can work out really well. If they are wrong, it will work out badly. Someone was talking to me about a company that I was skeptical of, right, in the insurance industry, because I felt they weren't increasing their rates fast enough. And I felt that they were behind the curve such that they were going to continue to...
Is it Globe Life?
No, it's not Globe Life. that has other issues. Don't ask me about that company. It's a McKinney company. I actually know that company. I've been to their offices and stuff. I don't know people who work there and stuff, but So they were raising their rates behind, like what they would say is, okay, our costs are going up 20% this year. We want to raise our rates at 9% because we think that they will, on average over the next few years, get down to a level where it will have averaged that over these 3 or 4 or 5 years. And we're going to do it smoothly so as not to lose customers because we know that we lose people when we do it more aggressively. Now, that was an insurance product that is more discretionary. So the great thing about car insurance in the United States, there's a few other kinds of insurance like this, but car insurance is like the best. No one wants car insurance. I mean, for the most part, many people want the minimum amount of car insurance they can get, but many people are in places where they are required by law to have a certain amount of car insurance, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The great thing about it, though, is although it can have bad pricing, the one thing you've got going for you is that no insurers believe they can sell you a second policy if it's cheap enough, right? Everyone thinks I can sell you this. You want such amount of coverage. Either I'm going to get you or someone else is going to get you. And so that's the one thing that it really has going for in the competitive dynamics that's good. It's very bad when we're talking about inflation. You know, we're talking about inflation and stuff about pricing things. That's not as good as Lime or something, but that's what Lime has going for it. As the great thing about it with when we talk about Lime and aggregates and cement things and whatever, there's a few things going. One is that they don't think they can steal customers that easily because you're going to be whoever's closest to the plant is going to be the most economical one to do it. Yes. But there's another aspect to it. No one thinks that if I cut my, when capacity is unused, that by cutting my prices, I can get you to consume more of it. No one thinks, oh, I'll cut the price of gravel in half and you'll just buy a lot of it. They think you only need X amount and there's nothing I can do about that. It's really hard to do that. On pricing, they might think I could outprice someone who's a little further away if I go a little bit cheaper and I can win you over, whatever. If it's a big freight cost thing, they can't even do that, but they might think that. With car insurance, that's what they think is do I get your policy or do I not get your policy? But the one thing that at least it has going for it is no one thinks they can sell you more and more. The problem with the one I was talking about is that certain products are very heavily discretionary in that, warranties, right? So consumer product types, things that are on that, some things that are warranty things, some things that are home service plans. I'm sure people know about like American Home Shield or things like that. Those things depend a lot on pricing, how they're billed, how small you make the bill look in terms of how you break it up, and what things you cover and stuff. Most people don't need that coverage or want that coverage, and so it has to be sold more to them, you know, all that stuff. Same thing with like whole life or something, right? Like if you have a sales force, you could go out and sell people on this product, but if it wasn't there, I don't know that anyone buys it on their own anyway. But car insurance, they do. And so it's just a question of whether you get it or someone else gets it. So it's purely a competitive thing, you know, between Geico and Progressive and stuff. But like I said, the one thing that's at least good about it is they don't try to think that they could sell more of it. The scary thing with the ones we were talking about the more tangible businesses is those are the ones you don't want to be in when things are bad, because there is a temptation to think that you could sell more to people by cutting your prices. And that happens in things that where you see inventories build up and stuff. Anything with inventories can have that problem. And inflation is complicated in how it affects inventories and stuff. The thing with inflation that also people should look at is free cash flow, because you start to have more and more of a separation between cash flow numbers and earnings numbers, and especially things that are not captured in EBITDA. So I feel like, I mean, you read lots of stock write-ups and stuff. How often do people talk about EBITDA instead of, say, cash flow from operations?
The majority of the time.
Yeah. And if inflation is high enough, if we were living in Turkey, people would learn don't use EBITDA. Because because if you're running a business, you'd say, oh, my EBITDA is looking great. And then at the end of the month, you would go and somehow there's no cash in the till. How did this happen? Because of inflation, right? Because if things are inflating fast enough, then you sell a product, you go to buy it, and you go, oh, I'm using more money to buy this product than I sold this one for, which doesn't necessarily mean that I'm losing money because I'm going to sell this next one for even more. But if you had 60% inflation, you would pick up on that. You'd realize that every time you try to sell something to generate cash, you're not generating cash, but each time you're selling something, you're selling it for more than you bought that thing for. But you can't replace the new thing that you just sold with something that you're buying now for cheaper. So you just have this problem where you're saying that you're earning money, but you're not generating cash from it, you know? So that's the other thing that I would focus on, is the difference between cash flow from operations and EBITDA and stuff. And basically that matters for companies that have working capital, mostly inventory, but also receivables. So like service type businesses and businesses that have none of that are going to look different. So we did Cedar Fair, right? So yep. That one is a business which probably has very, very low working capital. it's probably planted equipment. But you think about it, you know, a regional theme park or something, a regional, you know, amusement park, right? People are showing up, they're paying them with their credit cards or whatever is being collected instantly or in a couple of days. And there's not bills out to people that are being paid over time. And there's not really a lot of inventory either. Everything's being consumed, used up, paid that day. So that stuff is going to be the gap between EBITDA and cash flow from operations is going to look that different. When we talked about Dollar General, we talk about someone asked a question about Tandy or something. Things that have inventory that's sitting there for a while could start looking like their earnings are good, but their cash flow might not be that good, right? Because inventories are so big. I don't know what companies that is specifically, but any company where you have really high inventories, you may start to realize that cash is not being generated at the same levels that it was before and to be worried about that. I always think people should pay more attention to the quality of earnings that way, but especially in times of inflation, it's an important thing to focus on because you'll notice the gap.
Got it. Cool. Well, I want to thank everybody so much for tuning in with the both of us on the Focus Compounding Podcast. Be sure to hit that subscribe button wherever you are listening or watching us here today. If you'd like to send in a question that we can discuss on the podcast, you can send it to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com. If you're going to Omaha for the Berkshire event and you'd like to meet up with Jeff, reach out to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com. I want to thank everybody so much for all the support, and we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.